Yesterday morning, just as I was supposed to be leaving for men's breakfast, my electronic devices started making noises to indicate that somebody wanted to speak to me. Turned out to be my niece, who wanted to talk to me about her coming wedding. And to talk to me about wedding invitations. Wedding invitations put us in a place where we anticipate an event where we will need to, in some way, prepare. I remember a little bit later in the day, Maggie and I were driving somewhere, and she said to me something about, I'll need a new dress for the wedding. Because she wanted to... I said yes, by the way. Just in case you were wondering whether I said we can't afford it. No, I said yes. Of course. But you know, she was already beginning to think that it was necessary to prepare for the event that is going to take place. If you don't think that preparations are necessary for weddings, ask Carissa. Because if you walk into some of these things unprepared, disaster ensues. You know, if you're English, you are very familiar with what's known as a royal protocol. There are ways in which you speak to and about the royal family. If you watched The Crown, which I know lots of you did, you discovered that sometimes they were reluctant to follow those guidelines, but nevertheless, there is a way in which you speak to and around the royal family. It's protocol, it's respect, it's the way you behave in their presence. And we're going to talk this morning about how we behave in the presence of God. If we believe that when we come here, we come into the presence of God, then I'm going to suggest, need to think a little bit about how we behave in the presence of God. Because I remind you that Athanasius said about the Psalms that we're going to look at, he said that most of the scriptures speak to us, but the Psalms speak for us. Because in the Psalms we learn, because David unloads his heart before God. Sometimes positively, sometimes negatively, but always dramatically. And he talks to God in ways that we sometimes think we can't. We sometimes believe, it sometimes seems, as if we believe we've got to have all sorts of special language. Now, for us, reading the Psalms sounds special, but it wasn't for him. He unloaded his heart to God. And we also remember that as we go through the Old Testament, we see the people of God, the Hebrews, learning about God. They are discovering God. They don't have the amount of information that we have. And so when they respond to God or they ask questions of God, they don't have all the stuff that we have to help them answer. So it's really important to understand those things when we look at the things that, particularly in the Old Testament, they say. Now, the psalm that we're going to look at this morning, Psalm 15. If you have your Bibles, that would be a good place to open it. If you don't have your Bibles, there's some guys will hand them out. The passage will be marked for you. But I want to begin by explaining to you something about what the context of this psalm is. Now, I want to say straight off the bat that we aren't certain that this is the context that David wrote this psalm. It wasn't the response to this situation that David wrote the psalm, but it seems to be really, it seems there are all the indications that the context, that this is the context in which he wrote. In all probability, it's an incident that is one of those incidents that as a preacher, you wish, you hope you never have to preach about. Because what happened was, I'm going to give you the cliff notes. What happened was the two extraordinarily bad sons of Eli went to war, and they took the Ark of the Covenant, which was the sacred place that they identified with the presence of God. They took it with them into battle as a sort of lucky charm. In the possibility that despite their bad behavior, that if they had the ark with them, God would not desert them. Now, what happened was they got soundly beaten, and the Ark of the Covenant was captured by the Philistines. Now, this did not work out well for the Philistines, because everywhere the ark went, disaster fell down upon them. And so it's a great story. It would make a great movie. If you want to read about it, it's in 1 Chronicles chapter 15 and 16. I can't tell you the whole story, but what happened was they put it on a cart, they sent it back to Israel because they thought, this is happening. Everything's going wrong wherever the ark is. And it went to a couple of places, and then finally David decided he was going to bring it back. He was going to bring it back. And so he got put together a brand new cart and some oxen, and he put the ark on, he got the covenant on the back of the oxen, and off he went to come back. Now this guy called Uzzah, who was helping along, he put his hand out to steady the cart. And he touched the ark, and he immediately died. And God said, look, I told you how you were to transport the ark. Very specifically. You were to do it it was to be carried by certain specific people in a specific way. You put it on a new cart. You did not do what I asked you to. And David was profoundly upset with God. It says in 2 Samuel chapter 6 and verse 8, David was angry because the Lord's anger had burst out against Uzzah. David couldn't understand why he seemed to be doing the right thing, but everything had gone wrong. And that is a really difficult situation. That's why I say that if you're a preacher, that's one of the passages you really hope won't come up for you to preach. If you're really interested in the subject, there's a really good book called God Behaving Badly, which really looks at that particular passage and helps us to understand it. Because if you don't see it in the context of what God is, how God is revealing himself to the people of Israel, then it seems utterly random. It wasn't random. God was making the point to the people of Israel that you need to take some notice of the things I tell you. That I'm God. I'm in control. I've given you all sorts of promises to look after you. But if you disobey me, you need to know that there are consequences. And so it's in that context that God chooses to do something to give David and the people of Israel a wake-up call. Now, we may sit here and say, well, I don't think that was really very, that wasn't very nice. Well, he's God. And we don't get to decide whether he behaves the way we think he should. And all of the time we waste our time trying to get God to behave the way we think he should, we're wasting our time. God, in that situation at that time, delivered them a wake-up call. Now, I think that then when you come to this psalm, that what David is remembering, this that particular incident as he was desperate for the fact, how am I going to get this? What am I going to do? And he says, who can come? Who may worship who can come to your holy hill? Chapter Psalm 15 and verse 1. He says, who can come there? Who can worship in your sanctuary? That the word that's translated sanctuary in the New Living Translation is also translated tent, which is quite important. Who can come into your tent? Because what David did, as we see in 2 Samuel 6 and verse 17, David made a special tent for the ark, and as he brought it back, he put it in a tent. And so David is saying, who can come in? Who can worship you? Who can come into your presence? Who's allowed to do that? Well, you know, this guy, sort of, he was doing, okay, so he made a bit of a mistake, but why? Who can come into your presence? Because David, he reveals to us in Psalm 4 and verse 5 that David recognized that evil and God were totally incompatible. That in Psalm 5, he said this in Psalm 5 and verse 4. He says, For you are not a God who delights in wickedness. Evil may not dwell with you. Evil may not dwell with you. Evil can't be in the presence. You can't be in the presence of evil. So, what can we do? Who can come into your presence? Who can come into your presence? And you know, we might say, well, yes, we recognize that that is a difficult situation for David, but it doesn't apply to us. Because we remember Hebrews chapter 4, where it says that we can boldly approach the throne of grace. So for us, who may approach God in his sanctuary? Anybody. Anybody who will boldly approach the throne of grace. So, really, we can discount this psalm. I suggest the answer to that is no. Because I suggest that the principles that we're going to see in this psalm tell us something really important. And the fact that we can, as easily as God allows us to, approach the throne of grace, which is what you did, what I did when we walked through the door this morning, the fact that we can do that so easily renders the danger of doing so without consideration so much easier. That it is so easy for us to stroll into the presence of God, dominated by what's happened before. I can't count the number of times when something goes wrong in our house, particularly if you have children, something goes wrong in your house just before you come to church. And you're coming into the presence of God. Okay, we're in the presence of God all the time, I know. But we come into a special experience of the presence of God, and all hell has broken loose around us. And it's really hard to be prepared for worship. And so it's easy for us to stroll in, dare I say it, to stroll in late. What's late? I'm here, aren't I? Well, yes, but a group of people have been on their knees for a week preparing worship for us that may lead us into the presence of God. And if we miss half of it, we miss half of what God has prepared for us. Because I believe with all my heart that we have a worship team that prayerfully puts what they have together in order that we might come into the presence of God. If I miss half of it, or I miss the first song and I'm sort of trying to collect myself for the second, I miss something about what God has for me. that morning. It's easy for us to get casual about coming into the presence of God because of the amazing grace that God has given us, the promise of his presence, the fact that he doesn't say, well, if you don't prepare properly, I'm not going to be there. I will go home early. He doesn't say that. And so somehow we get accustomed to, and we model for those younger than us, that it's okay to be unprepared and to be uncommitted and stroll into the presence of God. And I think that's where David is coming from. And so he says, when he says, who may worship in the sanctuary of the Lord? What we're going to see is some things that should challenge us in the way we prepare ourselves to come into God's presence and to worship him. Because he's God. You know, if people prepare themselves to go to a wedding because they want to honor you, if you stroll in a pair of sweats and some sneakers, you're not really honoring the couple that are getting married, are you? If you did that to the Queen of England, if you were English, I mean, if you drew that for the Queen, that would not be honoring. And if she asked you to come at 12 for a midday for a dog garden party, as she frequently does, and you said, okay, well, I'll be there probably about 1. But you know, I'll be there. You know, be grateful. I'll be there. But just think about it. Is that the way we treat God? I'll be there if I can. If not, maybe I'll make it next time. Who then can worship in your sanctuary? And David has clearly thought this through, and he's learned some things. Now, that what we believe is the way in which this particular psalm was used was it was used almost as a liturgy. If you don't know what that means is it's sort of like a form of service. Like what we do here when we have 3 songs of worship, we then have some prayer, then we have another song, then we have a message. That's a liturgy. It's an order of service. If you go to an Anglican church or a Catholic church, the liturgy is much more extensive, but it's still a liturgy. It's the order of which you do things. Now, what they suspect happened was that when the Israelites came up to the temple at festivals, at the big, you know, the big shindigs that they used to have, the people at the door would ask them these questions. They would ask the question, and then they would respond. The people at the door would respond. This is the people. This is the characteristics of those who can come into the presence of God. And the first one he says in 15 and verse 2. Yes, there are actually 10 things. 10 things that he points out. First of all, he says the people who lead blameless lives and do what is right, speaking the truth from sincere hearts. Oh well, when you first read that verse, you say, okay, well that rules me out, because when was I ever blameless? Well, you don't get off that light, because we need to understand what that word means. What that word means is that we have an integrity and a consistency of life. That we, when what we, and he goes on, speaking the truth from a sincere, we do what is right, we speak the truth from a sincere heart. What those two phrases actually amplify the blameless life. They're actually saying that somebody who leads a consistent life, a blameless life, is really what you do when nobody's looking. A few weeks ago, we talked about and thought about what goes on behind our front doors with the people who know us best, who understand, who see us at our worst. What David is saying, the people who live consistent lives of integrity, which means they do the right thing and they walk the talk and they speak sincerely. The challenge is if we behave differently here than we behave at home, then that's calls into question the blamelessness of our life. Sometimes doing the right thing is risky because we're not quite sure how people will respond. Sometimes doing the right thing is saying no to something when you'd like to say yes, but you know that you're supposed to say no. Sometimes doing the right thing is unpopular. Sometimes, dare I say it, it's inconvenient. And, you know, some of the governing principles of our lives is, I don't like what's inconvenient. So when we leave lives as we learn to be followers of Jesus, that Jesus's demands on our life become absolutely first and foremost, it gets risky, it gets inconvenient, it gets painful at times, but it is right. And when our lives get transformed into, we begin to be consistent, and the governing principle of Jesus in our lives becomes more and more apparent. We do what is right. We speak the truth from sincere hearts. We walk the talk. And talking, however, is really quite important. Because Ephesians chapter 4 underlines, it was as important to Paul as it was to David. Because he says, you will speak the truth in love, growing in every way more and more like Christ. You see, that transformation process that's been taking place in our lives as we grow more and more like Jesus, we become more and more devoted to him, that transformation will be characterized at least by speaking the truth in love. There are times when I've preached on that passage that I said, speaking the truth, if you can't speak it in love, don't speak it. Leave it out. Because if it's not characterized by love, then the compassion of Christ is not evident in what we say. So, having given us some things that we should do, he's now going to tell us some things that we shouldn't. So we're going to move to verse 3 when he says this. Those who refused to gossip or harm their neighbors or speak evil of their friends. Those are the people who are characterized in the first verse. This one says that they will refuse to gossip. My friends, I believe that gossip is one of the most pariahs in our church and in our culture. There is nothing that is so powerfully dividing and so detrimental to unity and to relationship than gossip. I looked for the word to see exactly how it was defined. And it's defined as idle talk or rumor, especially about personal or private affairs of others. I'm going to repeat that because I think we need to remember it. Idle talk or rumor, especially about the private or personal affairs of others. I was listening to a podcast recently by a guy called Scott Sauls, and he made this comment which really rocked me backwards. He said, gossip is pornography of the mouth. It seeks a cheap thrill at somebody else's expense with zero commitment to them. It seeks a cheap thrill. Paul picks up the dangers of gossip in Romans chapter 1 and verse 29. When amidst all of these things, he said, full of every kind of wickedness, sin, greed, you know, what company he puts gossip in. Malicious behavior and gossip. And he says the same thing in Corinthians. He puts it in the same company. That when we talk idly about other people, that's the company our behavior gets in. I was talking to a friend recently, pastor's wife, who had been through a really difficult and painful situation in their church. And clearly some people had been talking idly, particularly about her husband, especially about his personal or casting innuendos about his personal behavior. And she said, those people who kept quiet, some of whom said, I know that they're saying this, but I just decided I was going to keep quiet. She said, that was the equivalent of stabbing me in the back. Because they weren't prepared to take the risk and stand against idle and destructive conversations. I cannot tell you enough, my friends, how important this is. We should resist these type of conversations like we resist the most dangerous of diseases. Gossip divides and destroys. In Proverbs, it says, a man who lacks judgment derides his neighbor, but a man of understanding holds his tongue. A gossip betrays a confidence, but a trustworthy man keeps a secret. You know, we have so many magnificent ways of rationalizing gossip. I just want you to pray. She didn't tell me it was a secret, so I suppose I can tell you. I just thought you needed to know. No, we don't. The fact that she gave you a confidence that means that for you to tell somebody else is a breaking of that confidence, even if he or she didn't specifically tell you not to. And you know, for prayer, we don't need to know who somebody is. I told you a story today about somebody who I have spent some time with talking to this week. You don't need to know their name to pray for them. You don't need to know their name to say thank you to God for what he did. Because God knows their names. Sometimes I believe that we believe that we need to know all these different details in order to tell God. He already knows. He already knows. So I want to ask us within our own communities to fight gossip with every fiber of our prayerful bodies. To when we hear it, we resist it and we walk away from it. When we are tempted to do it, we ask God to stop us doing it. When we hear it done, we are prepared to hear the rebukes of those who love us and care for us. It must be eliminated. If we are to be the people who God calls us to be, bringing compassion and care, bringing love and healing to a world that so desperately needs it. So we don't gossip and we don't speak badly of our neighbor. Let's look at that verse again. 15 verse 4. Because he says some other things refuse to gossip or to harm their neighbors or speak evil of their friends. to harm their neighbors or speak evil of their friends. You know, the sense of the particularly speaking, harming their neighbors and speaking evil of their friends says, you tell people things, that the sense of the words of the user, you're telling people things that without concern as to how it's going to affect your perspective on that person. And the second part of speak evil of their friends, really the sense of that suggests that people rake up old information. I was listening to somebody talk about somebody, and I was and I said to Meg, I wonder how long ago that person did what they're being talked about. I'm specifically doing this to make sure that you don't. I don't need to know who I was talking about or what. I wonder how long ago. Because if it was 20 or 30 years ago, which it was distinctly possible that it might be, would you like to be have somebody judge you or based on something you said, thought, or did 30 years ago? But very often people don't say, well, they did this 30 years ago, 20 years ago. But we rake up, and they're supposed to be our friends. So we did it just for prayer. I'm sorry, but I can't tell you how strongly I feel about the danger that this represents for the community and for the body of Christ. And I know that I can be just as guilty of it as anybody. But I want to root it out of my life. And the only way we're going to do that is by doing it together and resisting it together. I remember somebody telling me of the occasion when they were stood on the playground at school and they were suddenly conscious of the conversation amongst the people around them was going in this direction, and so they turned around and walked away. Oh, may more of us do that over and over, because after a while, people will get the message that you are not interested in idle talk about other people. That you don't want to rake up the past. And you don't want to be quiet so that you effectively stab that person in the back because you did not stand up for them. We have this wonderful thing, don't we? Everything's okay as long as it doesn't bring anybody any harm. Let me ask you this question. Who decides what harm is? Who decides? You? Me? When we're going to say something, well, it's not going to harm anybody. How do you know? How do you know? And you may never know. I'm sure that the majority of people who harmed that family that I was talking about earlier, they don't know that they harmed them. They didn't think they were harming them. But they didn't follow the guidelines. I love this. I found this quote in a blog by a young lady called Erin Davis. She said, I have decided, I hope to remember God's definition of gossip. If it doesn't glorify him and highly esteem others, I will keep my mouth shut. Let me repeat that for you. If it doesn't glorify him, that's God. If it does not glorify him and highly esteem others, I'll keep my mouth shut. I suggest to you that certainly for me, that is a really good guideline for my conversations. And then, so we move on to verse 5. And he says, verse 4, sorry, and he says, those who despise flagrant sinners. Again, he's going back to the sort of thing that we were talking about in Psalm 1, where he says, you know, keep away from those people who clearly do not want God to govern their lives. Keep away from them because they will push you in directions that you don't want or need to go in and that are dangerous. Because you should honor the faithful followers of the Lord and keep and those who keep their promises even when it hurts. I have no compunction whatsoever about saying we honored one of them earlier today. We honored somebody who is a faithful follower of the Lord and has kept their promises even when it hurts. Even when it hurts. Isn't it interesting that today everything is tentative? If you work with teenagers, you discover that big time. Well, will you come to such and such? Or will you? Well, yeah, maybe. Will you sign? No. Something better might come up. Something different might come up. But let me ask you this, my friends. Where did they get that from? Is it not possible that that's what we've modeled for them? Maybe in a slightly different way? That we have modeled for them the tentative nature that is part of life. And the faithful followers of the Lord that keep their promises even when it hurts, those who will be committed and will not change their minds, who will do what God calls them to do regardless of what comes along. Are we modeling that for our young people, my friends? Are we? If so, why am I, if I do that all the time, why am I so surprised when my children behave the same way? I wish I could make this easier for us, but it isn't. God says when we come before Him, we need to check ourselves. That we are living with consistency. That we are living with integrity. That we are avoiding the dangers of gossip. We don't speak of people the wrong way. That we stand for what is true and right. We are a faithful and committed followers of Jesus. That's where we need to check ourselves. And then lastly, then in verse 5, we get something which is really extremely culturally sensitive. Because he says, those who lend money without charging interest and who cannot be bribed to lie about the innocent, such people will stand forever. Really, that reflects some verses in Deuteronomy and a lot of others. And really, the essential nature of it is cultural, because what they're saying is that if you let... Deuteronomy chapter 23 says this: do not charge interest on loans you make to a fellow Israelite, whether you loan money, food, or anything else. Now, that's not a racial statement that says, you're supposed to be prejudiced. This is a statement that says if they were lending money to fellow Israelites, it was almost absolutely certain that this was a person who was in need. A person who was going through difficult circumstances and needed help. Because the next verse says you're allowed to charge interest to foreigners. What that means, which is being translated, you can charge interest in business. In business transactions, you can charge interest. But when you're dealing with your fellow Israelites, you will almost always be dealing with people who are in need, and you cannot abuse them. You cannot abuse them. That business is okay. And so what he's basically saying to us is, look, check yourselves. Are the ways in which you are behaving in an oppressive way to other people? Are the patterns of our behavior which are not generous to those who have less than us? Are we allowing God to challenge us moment by moment to be more and more sensitive to the poor and the needy throughout the world? If you live in America, you're in the top 5 or whatever percent of people. I don't know what the, as far as stuff being had is concerned. So he challenges us. And then let's go back to verse 5, because the way he finishes up is so great. Because he said, such people will stand firm forever. Now, that at first you might not think that sounds that remarkable, but then go back to what the question that was asked in the first place. Who can come into the who can come into the presence of God? Who can dwell with God? He says, as God transforms our lives into this sort of life, we can't just come into the presence of God. We can stand firm forever. Our eternal security has been dealt with. That's much bigger than where we started. David tells us that if we are being transformed into the way Jesus that wants us to live our lives, our eternal security, we're not just able to come into the presence of God, but we can anticipate being in the presence of God for eternity. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? So, as we gather around the Lord's table, I want to ask you a couple of questions. Right at the beginning, we heard that David was given a wake-up call by God. What happened to Uzzah gave David a wake-up call that as the leader of the people of Israel, did he put enough importance to obedience to the things that God told him to do? Did he pay attention to the details of the things that God told him to do? Or did he say, well, close enough? Which is basically what he did with the new cart and the new oxen. It seemed great. And he said, well, you know, it's close. It's good. I've really made an effort. No, you didn't listen to what I said. And I know that for me, I need that wake-up call over and over again. When did I not pay attention to the details of what God asked me to do? When did I say close enough, or that's the best I can do? And you know, when things like that go wrong and it is so frustrating and we say, I did my best. I think sometimes God, yes, but I need you to understand that obedience to my call is what I'm asking for. I'm asking you to be my child and follow my way. Not when it's convenient and not when good enough seems to be a place where we can get by. And then when we come into God's presence, whether it be coming to church on a Sunday morning, or maybe when you have your quiet time in the morning, do you stroll into God's presence? Oh, I forgot my coffee, or I don't have long today. Now, I'm not saying that God requires this amount of time or that amount of time or this. I'm not saying that. What I think that the psalmist is challenging us with is, what's the attitude with which we come into the presence of God? Is it, I am coming to spend time with the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords? And everything about my attitude and my preparation should reflect that. Everything. Sometimes I think that, you know, we do these things. Maybe I'm revealing something about myself here, but if you look very carefully, you could almost interpret it as we think we're doing God a favor. Well, I came, didn't I? You should be pleased to see me. He is. I gave you that much. I mean, look, come on. I'm getting there. When we come into the presence of God, does the time we arrive, The preparation we take to get there. I don't know. I think I've only just begun to learn what preparation to come into the house of God is all about. I always listen to the worship set that we're going to have on Sunday mornings. I can't tell you how often that blesses me and says things to me that I hadn't got otherwise. I'm not saying you should do that. I'm saying what we should be doing is doing something which says, I am prepared. I am checking through where I am with you, Father, as I come into your presence. I'm not pretending. I'm not overlooking. I'm coming into your presence and I'm saying, Lord, this is who I am. And we're going to gather around the Lord's table now. And I'm going to suggest to you that as we do, you say this. This is me. I know that there are all sorts of bits and pieces of me that don't reflect the things that it should. But I'm coming to you and I'm asking for the cleansing that you gave me when you died on the cross. And I want to bring to you a heart of worship that is all about you. Let's pray. Father, we recognize that you have standards that we cannot by ourselves keep up. There are so many of the things we've talked about this morning, certainly that I do on a regular basis, and yet, Lord, I want to be though that person who can come in, can be blameless as I come into your presence. Lord, thank you that as we gather around your table, we remember exactly what you did to purchase that cleansing. Lord, may we eat and drink to your glory, to your healing and to your cleansing. For we ask it in your name. Amen.